I'd like to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Courtney White. He's co-founder of the Kivira Coalition. He's the author of three books. His latest book is The Age of Consequences, A Chronicle of Concern and Hope. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. Thanks for having me back again.
It's just great to have you. I love your writing. I love the way you write, not just what you say, but I've been reading this book over the last few days, and I feel like I've been hanging out with you and with your family and all these places that you've gone. It's an interesting book because it's kind of a hybrid. I mean, it's part memoir, it's part travelogue, it's description of some really innovative and inspiring people and projects that are going on in conservation. It's partly analysis of where we're at now and where we might go as a nation, as a world. How did you come to write this particular book?
Well, so the book is divided into two parts, and that's where the concern and the hope come from. And the first part, which is the concern, and these are a group of essays I have written over time, grew out of a desire to begin to chronicle, you know, kind of write down some things that I was feeling and seeing at the time that didn't kind of fit larger projects. And it started really just as an online project. I just decided that I needed to say some things. I didn't have a forum. With a friend of mine, we created a website called The Age of Consequences, and I just began to post them there. And then that kind of went over time, started in 2008, kind of proceeded through 2011, 2012. And then I had a chance to bundle them together with some ranching essays, kind of a best of the agricultural stuff I've been writing. And I submitted it to Counterpoint Press, which is a literary press in California, with the blessing of Wendell Berry, who, that's his press.
And he wrote the foreword.
And he wrote the foreword. He wrote the foreword. And I know Wendell, and it was a tremendous honor and a blessing not only have him endorse the book and send it to his publisher, but eventually to write the foreword as well. You know, what I was trying to do, this was a more of a literary project than a activist or a, you know, kind of a Kivira-esque type project where it looks at agricultural practices and hope that the world gets, you know, gets with it. This was something, this was more meditative, and it was inspired by our children, Sterling and Olivia, my wife Jen, and we have, the kids are now 16.
They're twins.
They're twins. And the idea really came to me, as I say in the introduction, one day when we were sitting around the kitchen table listening to NPR, listening to the radio, having breakfast, the kids were getting ready to go to school. This was in 2007, back when NPR did a kind of a long series about climate, following Al Gore's documentary and a lot of other stuff that was going on. And a story came on the radio about polar bears. And our children were eight, and they listened to the story about polar bears and climate and the concerns about polar bears, and they literally turned ashen sitting there in their chairs. You know, it was the first time they'd really had heard something like this, and they asked us, what's going to happen to the polar bears? And, you know, we were got off guard a little bit, so we reassured them, well, you know, the polar bears are going to be okay, that, you know, they've gone through a lot, and it's maybe not as bad as it sounds and that sort of stuff. And they trundled off to school, reassured. And I thought about it a lot later, you know, how do you try to explain what's going on to your children, be it the 8 years old or 10 years old or 16 years old, because this is the world they're going to get. We're doing the best job we can right now, working hard. But fundamentally, the challenges that we're working on and towards and trying to solve are ones that they're going to inherit. And so how do you explain this? How do you tell children, how do you explain to them the crazy behavior of adults? I mean, you can you know, you talk to them and you say, well, adults behave in mysterious ways. They behave in contradictory ways. They do things that are kind of nutty as well as lovely. But that doesn't quite answer the larger question about why are we going to bequeath them a world that's going to have so many challenges? And so I just began to process that, saying, okay, now what can I do? How can I try to explain this and then, you know, kind of go through it myself, trying to understand these issues? So I decided on Earth Day 2008 just to start writing essays, just trying to write down my thoughts about today, about tomorrow. You know, some of them focused right on kind of the world the kids are going to get, some of them a little bit larger, thinking about how we got here. Some of the essays are autobiographical about where I grew up, how I grew up, and then some of them kind of look into the future. And it was just a thing to do. It wasn't. I wasn't thinking about a book. I wasn't looking at selling it. You know, how do I market this? How do I make money? It was just something that from the heart and my concern just kind of channeled into short essays. Well, not so short, I guess, but into the essay format.
Yeah, a lot of them are pretty short essays, and yeah. It's kind of a pleasure to read. And you can, if you want to, sort of skip around and read about whatever you've come across at that moment. But something that you write about that I really related to was this concept of what you call the big fiesta. What do you mean by that?
Right. So the book is called Age of Consequences, and that's a term that I borrowed from Winston Churchill via Al Gore's documentary. Winston Churchill, in the run-up to World War II, said we live in an era of consequences, meaning that our actions have consequences. And in that case, it was rise of Hitler and the fact that they didn't confront him and deal with it earlier. And I thought, you know, that really resonated with me. We have a different set of consequences underway.
But the phrase, didn't deal with it earlier, really resonates with respect to climate change.
Right. And so the way I kind of looked at it historically was World War II, at the end of World War II, we entered into this, you know, phenomenal period of American history, global history, that I call the fiesta. We partied. I mean, we won the war, and the economy went crazy, and we just did all this stuff. It's the world my parents, who were 18 at the time, at the end of World War II, and, you know, were moved into, and I watched it manifest itself in Phoenix, where we had moved to in 1966 when I was just a child. And I watched the fiesta grow Phoenix from a cow town, really, a small little place, into this, you know, metropolis that it is today. So the fiesta was all that hard partying that went on. It was water development, it was sprawl, it was the car culture that got developed, it was fast food, it was a booming economy. You know, the incomes got lifted for so many people, and my parents especially, who were both born poor and pulled themselves up by their bootstraps, really represented kind of that generation. However, the fiesta, and we were told this by the fiesta's organizers, that there wouldn't be a hangover. Now, you party hard, no hangover. Well, there is a hangover. And I call the hangover the age of consequences. So that we have these actions, and they have consequences. There are also now consequences to inaction, which unfortunately is largely what's happening politically in this country. So we're not doing stuff that has to be done. So both action and inaction now have consequences. And I just picked a kind of a somewhat arbitrary date of 2005 in my mind is kind of the start where I think of the age of consequences. That's when Hurricane Katrina hit. That's when really a lot of consciousness got raised about these larger issues. And that seemed to be a kind of a appropriate dividing line between the party and the hangover. Unfortunately, we're still partying in a lot of levels, or thinking that the party can go on. However, the hangover is starting to really get pretty serious, I think. On April 1st, California's governor declared mandatory water cuts across the state. And this is big news. I mean, California is facing a serious situation, and it's directly consequence of, you know, what they did through the 60s and 70s and 80s that they're now grappling with.
I think one of the things that's so tricky about the big fiesta is that it affords so many people comforts and freedoms that we really like. And I think you're very honest about that in the book, growing up in Phoenix and as a teenager having quite a lot of freedom and fun.
Right. Yeah. You know, as I say in the book, my parents worked very hard to pull themselves up out of poverty. My father was a medical doctor, a neurologist, and by the time I hit teenage years, I benefited from the fruits of their labor. You know, I got a car at 18, and the interstate highway system was all set, and I hit the road, and I did a lot of fun things, rafting, hiking, archaeology. I got involved in, you know, summer programs in archaeology, all the things that their hard work and the fiesta that lifted them up financially and as well as materially. you know, I got to do. Now, we weren't wealthy or anything, but we had things that they didn't have growing up. And
well, it's the middle class.
It's the middle
of
class.
That period.
It was that classic rise of the middle class through the 50s and 60s, and allowing the children to have fun. And the fiesta in Phoenix, it was about rafting down the river, taking long drives, restaurants, you know, all those kind of things that come with an expanding culture. In the chapter that you're referring to, I call it, it was a modern version of Manifest Destiny. You know, back in the 19th century, America believed it had a destiny to overspread the continent from shore to shore. And in many ways, in the 60s, what happened to Phoenix was a kind of an updated version of that, without the gunslingers and the horses. It was, you know, we're going to overspread Phoenix. We're going to overspread the desert with this metropolis built on water, dams, and, you know, things that allowed people to live, air conditioning. And it was cool, to be honest with you. I mean, I didn't think about anything like consequences when I was growing up, though I did watch my desert, my beloved desert that we rode horses in and other things, disappear, I mean, over time.
Yeah.
And,
I mean, that seems to be the realization, the sort of initial realization, something's not quite right here.
Right. My father and mother rented a little dilapidated, little stable way out in the desert just to have a few horses and kind of do a little trail riding, called Powderhorn Ranch, and it was such a great place to roam around and make up games and stories and things. Well, it's Powderhorn Subdivision today, and it's completely buried under a very large suburban thing, and I watched it happen growing up in Phoenix. I watched the suburbs spread out. I watched the protest spread. There was a spray-painted protest movement called Save Our Desert, sprayed across all these real estate signs. And every year, they're farther and farther, you know, into the desert. And I remember talking to my father once about this, and because I was concerned. I was having, you know, my sort of environmental consciousness was starting to come up at the time. I asked him about it, and he really was not bothered by it, not interested, not bothered, because his generation, they didn't see loss happening. They just saw. They saw the upward track of progress. They didn't see the consequences, didn't feel that there was any downside, really, to what was going on. But at 15, I began to sense that maybe all was not as jolly as we were being told, you know? And now, when I go back to Phoenix, I just can't believe what I see. I mean, it's a huge, sprawling thing in the desert. The fiesta really embodied the fiesta in many, many ways. And now it embodies the age of consequences, because it's going to have to deal with some of the same issues that California is going through right now. Where's the water going to come from? How are we going to support 4 million people in a desert? You know, those kinds of stuff.
We're talking to Courtney White about his new book, The Age of Consequences. One of the things that I found really interesting was you write about everyone talks about the baby boom generation and the role of this generation in all the social change and environmental movements, but you kind of divide it up into the front and back end of the baby boom. What do you mean?
Right, right. And that was something that kind of came to me later. I was born in 1960. The baby boom generation stretches from 1946 to, what do they say, 1964? Something like that. And over time, as I got involved in Quivira, environmental issues, and other kinds of things, I began to see kind of a difference between folks who were born at the front end of the baby boom and those kind of born at the back end, which included myself. And in the front end, I was always greatly impressed by the folks who came of age during the 60s, the Vietnam War, the protests, all the kind of radical stuff that went on at the time. I was 8 in 1968, it was something I watched on television, but it wasn't something I was part of. And when I got involved in the environmental movement, I saw leaders of the environmental movement at that time being front-enders and being kind of carrying on that kind of confrontational attitude, which is, we got to fight the power, we got to stick it to fill in the blank, you know, the federal government, ranchers, whatever, and
Corporate bosses,
the system, you know, which I understood and I supported in general because, you know, these are things that need to be resisted to. However, and this is where Kivira comes in, is that I realized that there's also another route kind of built around reconciliation and about finding common ground solutions to problems rather than simply just brawling all the time. And so then the folks that I began to work with when we started Kivira were largely of my age, and I began to kind of see that there's sort of a, as I say in the essay, there's sort of a, imagine the baby boomers as a long parade. At the front end is a very noisy, aggressive, can-do, change-the-world kind of group, and at the back end are folks who are kind of picking up the pieces in some respects.
Including President Obama.
Including Obama, and this really kind of came to me when Obama began to run for president in 08, because some of his own rhetoric, he was positioning himself in contrast to Newt Gingrich, let's say, who was a front-ender. I mean, and Newt was exactly the kind of front-end, and frankly, so was Bill Clinton and George Bush. Folks who grew up in that movement had a certain kind of attitude towards politics, towards confrontation, towards kind of my way or the highway, which served them, I think, in a certain way, but it didn't serve finding solutions to these problems.
And it's interesting because that attitude pervaded the generation, whether they were liberal or conservative.
Right, right. It was just something about, and I'm no historian or sociologist, I couldn't tell you about kind of what fostered some of these kind of aggressive attitudes. But Obama, when he began to run, he said, look, you know, I'm trying to heal some rifts here. I'm trying to build coalitions, trying to do things that bridge divides rather than simply just get in there and brawl. And I really resonated with that. I mean, that's something that I, and he's almost exactly my age, 1 year younger. And it just all kind of fit this larger picture of a remarkably dynamic and successful movement, meaning the baby boomers, but the kind of split between those who stormed the castle and those who wanted to find some peacemaking common ground, kind of pick up the pieces and try to build something together. And I think that division extends to today.
Spanning not just the baby boom, but really the whole 20th century and up to the present, there have been successive waves of conservation. And I found this really interesting and helpful, right, the way you describe it in the book. What are these five waves, right, in the conservation movement?
Well, yes. And so at the end of the book, I wanted to kind of sum up some of my experience in thinking about how all these different kind of pieces of the puzzle kind of come together. And what I perceived was a movement, an environmental movement or a conservation movement that had its roots in the 19th century and extends up to today. But within that long stretch of time, there are five, what I think are five distinct waves. And I use the metaphor intentionally in the sense that a wave rises at a certain period of time. For certain reasons, it moves towards shore, it gathers strength. It, you know, it crests, it hits the shore, it reaches the kind of the apex on the shore, and then it pulls back over time and is replaced by the next wave that comes in. So each wave builds on successive waves, and yet it rises for different reasons at different times. So in conservation, looking at it that way, in the beginning, the first wave, starting with the national parks in the 19th century, was really built around federalism, about the idea of a federal response to all the kind of nasty stuff that was going on, clear-cutting, mining, and the decision by the federal government to hold on to certain lands, and not just national parks, but BLM land, forest lands, the creation of the National Forest System by Theodore Roosevelt, was definitely the first wave. And it was radical. It drew amazing people like Aldo Leopold. It became a forest ranger in 1909. That's where you went. That was the cutting edge at the time. And then it grew. It was effective. And then it diminished and was replaced by environmentalism, which was the second wave led by John Muir, and which built on kind of the federal idea, but it tackled other things. And then eventually it got angry at federalism, you know, when that movement began to build dams and start doing clear cutting. So there was a very much a replacement of the first wave by the second wave.
Can you describe a little more the environmentalism of the second wave?
Sure. It really had its roots in hunting groups, wildlife groups, Thoreau in the 19th century, but it was really led by John Muir, and who deliberately created the Sierra Club in 1892 as an activist organization to promote national parks, in particular, to kind of defend conservation values in general. So it rose up kind of right behind federalism, but it overtook it and became sort of the dominant conservation force through the 30s and the 40s when the federal government became less effective at conservation. And then in the 50s, of course, the federal government was into building dams and clear-cutting the forest and really transitioned to kind of the problem rather than the solution. So the environmental movement, which was then called the conservation movement, and it became environmentalism until really later, was the second wave. And it drew activists, it drew young people. It was really the dynamic force up through the 40s. But like most waves, it crests in its effectiveness, it reaches its high point, and then it pulls back. And I think, for me, without any doubt, the conservation environmental movement has receded in effectiveness since then. A third wave gathered strength in the 40s and really, really crested in the 60s and 70s, which was kind of a science-based conservation. Nature Conservancy represents it. So it was driven by scientists largely, looking at private lands, looking at endangered species, really data-driven, unlike John Muir and the folks who were more romantic, really, in their outlook. So that rose, and so you had the whole kind of private lands, science-driven conservation movement.
So the idea was that if you want to do conservation, you need to have the data, and you need to really work with people who own the private land?
Yeah, well, it was really a response to the rise of ecology, the science of ecology, which in John Muir's day, through the 20s and 30s, just was, you know, basically didn't exist. It was thanks to folks like Otto Leopold and all the scientists that came up in the 30s and 40s and 50s driving conservation activities, a lot of it based on private land holdings. Nature Conservancy would buy critical habitat and preserve it, those kinds of things. So it was a shift from kind of an emphasis on public lands to private lands. But it also crested. Over time, it became less effective. And this is where sort of Kivira comes in. In the mid-90s, another wave rose. It was the collaborative conservation movement.
And this was something that I think is really interesting because there was this crucial moment where the Nature Conservancy bought a piece of land, hoping to quickly turn it around to the federal government. But that didn't happen because there was a great uprising among the people who lived there.
Right. So this, we're talking about the Gray Ranch, which is down in the Boot Heel of New Mexico. And the Nature Conservancy, the strategy had been to buy large, biologically important landscapes and then transfer them to the federal government if they could, or they would hold on to it to themselves. In this case, a very large ranch, the Gray Ranch, 400,000 acres, came available. The Nature Conservancy bought it and was planning to transfer it to the Fish and Wildlife Service when the locals went berserk. And they basically said, this isn't enough of this. You know, we're tired of folks cruising in here, buying land, putting us all out of business and giving it to the government. This has got to stop. That gave rise to the Malpai Borderlands Group, which is one of the early collaborative conservation groups in the whole West. And it was a conscious effort to bring conservationists, ranchers, scientists, public lands managers all together to manage a landscape rather than simply turn it over to the federal government.
And this was really important and really interesting because these were groups that were both ideologically and culturally really divided, conservationists and ranchers.
Right. Well, but it's important. It drew a different kind of rancher. It drew a different kind of conservationist. So the folks who were in the old schools, the old waves, environmentalists and kind of confrontational landowners, ranchers, weren't part of this. This was a new wave. This was folks willing to work in the radical center, willing to come together, try to find common ground in their projects and attitudes. And so it wasn't just simply a kind of a turning of the light bulb from one group to another. It was really a rise of a whole different set of folks. And that's why this whole thing is sort of is exciting, because one wave, people who are young at a certain point grow up in a movement, they kind of become stuck in that mindset. Their work is replaced eventually by other young people who come along with a different set of concerns and values, and that's really what happened with the fourth wave, which was a collaborative movement driven by folks trying to solve problems. And that that transaction, the Gray Ranch, happened in 1990, and that was really kind of a pivotal moment. So the fourth wave rose. There was a lot of hostility directed at it from the earlier waves. We don't want you working together. We don't want you solving these problems. You know, the wave grew and matured, and the collaborative movement really swept across the West, from just a few small groups to really kind of a big movement now. Not so controversial. In fact, universities teach collaborative conservation now in their classes. Shows you how far things have come. But my point is, and why the essay is called The Fifth Wave, is that that movement itself, which Quivira is very much a part of, we were started in 97, has matured and is about to be replaced by the next wave, which I think is an agrarian movement, what I call new agrarianism, which is young people trying to take a big step above simply working it out on the ground, but trying to solve larger global challenges with new ideas, kind of bringing food back into it, trying to bring profit back into it, trying to bring technology into things. And it's actually really quite exciting to watch, as a member of the fourth wave myself, to see the fifth wave, which are being driven by 20s and 30s-year-olds now, who don't have to fight those fights and now building on all these things that have happened before. And it's, you know, they bring this an amazing suite of skills to the table. They're collaborative. A lot of them are not confrontational. They have amazing skills, technology skills. You've interviewed Dorn Cox. Dorn is a very good example of his young farmer from back east who represents this next generation that's rising now. And I'm excited.
We're talking to Courtney White about his new book, The Age of Consequences, A Chronicle of Concern and Hope. I think one of the really interesting points about the transitions from one successive wave of conservation to another is the idea that that economics is part of this. It's not enough to say, oh, we're going to buy up all land in need of conservation. There's not enough money to do it. In any case, people need to make a living. They're not going to go away and leave the land empty anywhere in the world, including the United States. And to actually engage people who really love the land and are committed to it and have a tradition on that land, some of whom are managing it well, some of them not well,
right,
to engage them in conservation seems like a really wise strategy. And that's, of course, what you've devoted much of your career to.
Yeah, and looking at it through the lens of the conservation movement, economics were perceived for a long time by the movement as sort of the enemy of nature. That, you know, if you go back to the 19th century, the economy at the time was causing vast devastation. I mean, the forests were being chopped down, the mines, animals were being hunted. And so the response was not to reform the economy, but to actually protect it via federal ownership, so national parks, refuges, national forests. Over time, the idea of sustainable or, kind of progressive management that brings economics and profits into it rose. But that's been a long transition for the environmental movement, and there's still a lot of folks who are dead set against the idea that you can make a profit at some level out of conservation activities. What's happened in the last 20, 25 years is that you have sustainable practices rising, so we can do these things like produce food in a way that's organic, that's regenerative, that's healthy, that's also profitable. And that's been a kind of a big educational curve for both sides. So the the agriculturalists have to understand that there's a conservation element to it. I mean, this is about wildlife, and that the conservation community understands that without paychecks involved, that we're just not going to get the level of conservation that's required.
Well, not only that, I mean, there's yet another dimension to it, which is that, I mean, a lot of that kind of conservation was based on the idea that tourism and recreation could save land and conserve land. But of course, if you can afford tourism and recreation, you have to have money, which has to come from somewhere. That somewhere is going to be, directly or indirectly, companies, many of whom are destroying the very land that you're trying to conserve. So it's not really a solution.
Well, you know, I grew up in what was called the New West, and this idea that there was this new economy that came along in the 70s and 80s built around tourism and recreation, what they call the amenity economy. And so much of the West really embraced, you know, jazz festivals and, you know, ranching the view and fishing and those kinds of things. And a lot of economic activity happened, and it was good for a while. But in the end, it couldn't carry the weight, as I put it in the essay. I mean, it wasn't in a kind of economy that was place-based. It was going to collapse if gas prices got too high. It just wasn't going to stick with us for a long run, and it wasn't helping land get better. It wasn't helping us produce food that we needed to eat. It turned out to be a very shallow economy fundamentally, even though it helped a lot of towns in the West through time. What the new agrarian folks today are looking at is not a tourism-based economy, but a work-based economy. I mean, how do we fix creeks that are degraded? How do we produce food that we eat locally? How do we manage these landscapes for a variety of values for the long run? And now, you know, we live in the age of consequences. How do we deal with climate change? How do we deal with carbon in soils? How do we deal with, you know, drought, which is bearing down on a lot of parts? Tourism isn't going to solve those problems. And I think folks really woke up, especially after the 2008 crash, understood that that was kind of a chimera in a lot of ways. It's kind of an illusion that wasn't going to make it. It's the fiesta, you know, the tourism and recreation, really part of the party, frankly. You know, drive your SUV a long distance, go fishing, and then go home.
Part of what these young agrarians are doing, and in fact a lot of people are doing, who are combining conservation and economic activity on the land, not real estate development, but actually food production and things like that, are doing what you call carbon farming and carbon ranching. What do those things mean?
Well, yeah. And in a nutshell, it's basically you can manage land and plants and animals to pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and store it in the soils. And it's just, you know, it's a process that's been going on for billions of years. It's called photosynthesis. It's just the way plants separate carbon from oxygen and store the carbon in their roots and in the soils. And it's a very interesting way of trying to mitigate too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And it's a whole huge topic, but
it has huge potential.
It does. And what's neat about this, two things. One is the science of it, trying to figure out what's going on below ground. And microbiologists are my heroes, by the way. The folks who discovered, understand what's going on below the ground, which is something we don't think about much, all the microbes and the nematodes and all that kind of stuff, that science has exploded in the last 20 years. I mean, it's really quite incredible. And you link that to good management practices, grazing, farming, you know, whatever it is, habitat restoration, all of that has carbon consequences, positive carbon consequences. You can put more carbon back in the soil that's been lost over all these years. That can pull carbon out of the atmosphere. I mean, it's a win-win all the way around. But nobody really thought about it that way until, I'd say, the last 10 years. Partly because of the science, partly because these two worlds kind of are kept separate from each other, the above-ground world and the below-ground world. That's now come together, and this is what's firing up a lot of young people today. So they can link organic farming or, you know, progressive cattle management, grass-fed food to the microbes in the soil, which then links it to the climate and brings it all kind of together. And this is what I mean by these movements, these waves kind of building on each other, is that you can't do that without the progress the ways have represented. So you need collaboration, you need the federal government involved, you need the conservation community involved if we're going to solve these challenges. And that's kind of where we're at in the age of consequences. That's the hope part of this.
Well, one of the things is that some very interesting questions are arising. I mean, there are some small communities or small cities with lots of farms in the area, and you can actually have and envision a really viable local food economy. But then there are other situations, like you've got the Central Valley of California, which is vast and has way more potential for food than there are local communities. And then on the other hand, you've got Houston and Dallas, which have more people. Phoenix, for example, New York, which have more people than agricultural areas and water and so on to feed them. What are some of the, I mean, have we addressed this yet? Are there some innovative ideas brewing on this?
Well, and this is kind of the $64,000 question, is how do you take what's been beta tested for the last 20 years at small scales? So farming, ranching, conservation activities, restoration, environmental stuff. How do you begin to upscale that in a way that they can start feeding larger amounts of people? That's the leap that we have to do, and we're not there yet. I mean, what we've been doing for 20, 25 years is really beta testing all these innovations, all these ideas in carbon farming and organics and cooperatives and things that all kind of started at tiny little scales back in the early 70s have all kind of risen up now and are fairly widespread, but there's still pushpins on a larger map. And the question is, how do you begin to link those pushpins together to feed a large city? That's not clear, and that's what we're all kind of working on. Some of these systems may just be too large, in fact, or too dry to try to sustain. This is why I don't like the word sustainability very much. What are we trying to sustain? Are we trying to sustain Phoenix, which is really built on sort of extractive model of water use and land use that may not be sustainable in the long run? I don't know. The challenge that we all face, Mary Charlotte, is water, drought. All of this works slowly and much more difficultly in dry times. And we can talk about sustainability and resilience and regenerative practices all day, but if it doesn't rain, we have problems. And, you know, organic farms need rain as much as inorganic farms, you know. They're more efficient. They can capture water better. Well-managed ranches can capture water. It still has to rain and or snow. And that's, you know, and that's the challenge we face. And there's no simple answer there. You know, again, we live in the age of consequences. So we're living in, this is one of the consequences of climate change. It's going to be hotter and drier periods. What do we do? There are lots of things we can do. Have we done them yet? Or are we going to be able to do them at scale? These are questions that remain to be answered. Unfortunately, and here's the big issue for me, is that real resolution requires a functioning political system.
Yeah, there is that.
Which we don't have. Sorry, we just don't. Not on the federal level. And without Congress, you know, stepping in here, this is going to be hard to do.
Well, and one of the things you write about is how hard it is for people who are doing innovative practices on or near federal lands have real problems because bureaucracies are designed to stay the same, not change, to not embrace innovation. And so to get to the point where somebody says, oh, that's a good idea, let's try that, or let's let you try that, can be years, if not decades.
Yeah, and this is the funny time we find ourselves in. There's a lot of innovation. I mean, I go back, think about 25 years ago, and a lot of this stuff just simply didn't exist or didn't exist at scale. Now you come forward, and there's all this stuff going on. Carbon farming is a good example. Yet, how do we get past these obstacles that are kind of in the way of putting innovation on the ground? Bureaucracies being one, because bureaucracies are conservative. I mean, that's just the nature of a bureaucracy, is to kind of sit tight, not rock the boat, not get too excited about things. And on one level, that's good because they can kind of be a buffer to things. On the other hand, it becomes an impediment to innovation. And this and there isn't a simple answer to that. It kind of keep rapping on that door. Please open the door. Let us try these things. There's more activity today than before, which is encouraging. Is it happening at a scale that can help us through these problems? That's not clear yet. But I am excited by the innovation, by the young people, by the ideas that didn't exist, now exist. Again, we don't have to invent anything. We don't have to make, wait for some new technology to come down the road to solve our problems. We know what to do. We've known it for a while. Just now we've as the innovation rises, the challenges rise, and a little bit of a race kind of going on here.
Maybe the scale version of this will be the sixth wave.
Right. Well, yes. I know I'll live long enough to see the sixth wave. That's a good question. Because, the fifth wave, Kivira changed its mission. It sort of modified its mission in 2007 to put the word resilience into the mission statement. How do we build resilience and how do we bounce back? How do we handle these changes? And that's very much, I think, on the minds of fifth waivers today is resilience and how do you manage these landscapes under new normals? I mean, things change. I mean, how do you do it? Sixth wave, that's a good question. It kind of depends on decisions we make now.
Right.
What happens in the next 2 or 3 years on the climate front? Are we actually going to take some action here on the CO2 side of things? I mean, these are open questions. And, I'm hopeful, and yet I'm fretful, and I come back to my children. I think about them every day. On the one hand, there's more for them. There's more hope and opportunity on that innovative side. There's a lot for them to do. On the other side, the challenges are rising quickly, too. And they're aware of it. This is a generation that's growing up under the cloud, so to speak, of climate change. Whereas you and I, when we grew up, it's just something that we didn't think about these things.
The phrase hadn't even been coined.
Right. When Kivira got started in 97, we didn't talk about any of this stuff. We didn't even think about it. It was mostly about ranch management practices, collaboration, peacemaking, radical center kinds of things. And only in the last 10 years have we really started to think, as I try to explain in the book, that there's been an evolution in all our thinking about as the challenges evolve.
Well, one of the things that I really loved about the book was that it's written with tremendous love, not only for your children and your family, but for life itself, for travel, for this incredible set of opportunities that we have around us. I mean, you're right, it's a great time to be alive. It is a great time to be alive. And so there's not this sort of dour, pessimistic, gosh, what a terrible world we're handing on to our friends. And it's not only that, but it's like, there's this part in the beginning, toward the beginning of the book, where you are in the Museum of Natural History and looking at what Homo sapiens have done. And turns out that Homo sapiens tend to dominate a whole lot of species that they come in contact with and kill them. There's a lot of species that have gone extinct, including other hominids and so on. And at the same time, here you are writing about this while sitting in a restaurant and a pianist starts playing ragtime music. And you're like, people are awesome. We invented, we're killing the earth in some ways. We're also bringing up solutions, but we invented music.
Right.
We invented ragtime.
Right.
And that sense of a kind of musical and good-natured interaction with the world we live in is very much a part of it, and I think it's really important.
Well, and I'm on a daily basis amazed by us. We have this goodness to our nature, this inventiveness, this ingenuity, this musicalness, the laughter, all the good stuff about being human. In a struggle with our, the bad angels of our nature, the the ones that caused extinctions historically, that fought terrible wars, and we have this sort of struggle, fight in our nature, and some days you're hopeful that one side will prevail, and some days you worry that the other side will prevail. I remain hopeful because we do do good things as a species. We're tremendously imaginative. We are, classically a problem-solving species. Well, guys, we got lots of big problems right now. And again, I want to come back though to our political system, because we can be inventive and musical and artistic and wonderful on all these levels, but at some point it has to kind of break through economically, politically, which is tough right now. And so, it's for a lot of reasons. And I kind of go back and forth on a daily basis between that concern and that hope that the book is about, which I tried to capture in different ways, different places, different travels, maybe will be food for thought for other folks thinking about some of the same things.
Courtney White is author of the book The Age of Consequences, A Chronicle of Concern and Hope. It's the third of three books. I think we've had you on the air talking about all three of them over the years. And you've got a new book that you're working on that's going to come out soon.
Yeah, I'm right in the very last stages of finishing it up. It's really a sequel to both books, the Carbon book and then The Age of Consequences. It's called 2% Solutions for Thirst, Hunger, and CO2. What I'm doing in this is I'm taking these practices, this innovation that I talked about, this ingenuity, these things that have happened in the last 20 years, and writing 50 relatively short profiles of them. They cover all kinds of, from solar to ranching to aquaponics to composting, and the idea that there are these regenerative practices, they can feed people, they can fix things, they can answer a lot of our questions, a lot of our problems, if we allow them to blossom. And it's being picked up by Chelsea Green Press. It'll be out next fall. They're looking, it's four color, it's got lots of photographs. It's a way of trying to get students and journalists and policymakers kind of aware of the breadth of innovation that's happened, not just drill down right on sort of carbon ranching, which is what the first book was about, but really look at the whole array of sustainable, regenerative, resilient practices that have been developed in recent years that I'm excited about. And again, we don't have to invent them. They've been invented, they've been beta tested, they're out there, people are doing them. A lot of people don't know about them. And no one has linked them all together. And I think that's why Chelsea Green picked them up, because we tend to isolate farming from ranching, from solar, and there's the whole last section's on wildlife, looking at conservation, looking at beavers and looking at bees and looking at dung beetles. Dung beetles are cool. Dung beetles are great things. But we've treated them poorly over the years. And Now, the integration, the role of wildlife, nature, regenerative farming, all those kind of things kind of all link together in relatively short case studies kind of things with photographs. I'm hoping we'll reach a broader audience, to be honest.
Well, we look forward to talking to you when that book comes out. Meanwhile, people can find The Age of Consequences, A Chronicle of Concern and Hope, here in Santa Fe at Collected Works Bookstore. You can also find out more about the publisher, Counterpoint Press, at counterpointpress.com. Courtney White is founder of the Quivira Coalition and author. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, thanks again for a great conversation, Mary Charlotte.